This afternoon is going to be Tan Kimiko's last presence at one of our weekly Dhamma talks. He's leaving this week. And so we're going to do what we've done a couple times before and share the talk, do a kind of a tag team. And the topic that we thought we'd talk about is the four nutriments. In the Anguttara Nikaya, in the Book of Ones, the Buddha said that the one thing that all beings are sustained by is nutriment. And if the process of nutriment is fully understood, then one can make an end of suffering. Nutriment includes, but is broader than, physical nutriment, which is food. There's a sutta in the Samyutta where the Buddha talks about the four kinds of nutriment. And in that text, he gives four very powerful images or metaphors for the four kinds of nutriments. These are among the most stark kind of images in the canon. The nutriment of physical food, he introduces with a story of a family traveling across the desert. There's a man, a woman, and their infant son. And halfway across the desert, they run out of provisions. So after a few days, they're weak and starving, and they can't carry on. So with great reluctance, they decide the only way they're going to be able to cross the desert is to kill their son and eat him. So they kill their infant son and make a meal and then dry the rest of the meat in the sun to use as provisions to carry on. And the Buddha says, do you think while they were eating that meat, do you think that they relished the taste? Do you think that they ate for enjoyment, for pleasure, for beautification, for satisfaction? No, they only ate for the maintenance of the body. The second kind of nutriment, the other three are all basically related to mental nutriment, because our mind is fed, preserved in an analogous way to the body. It too takes in nourishment. And the second one is the nutriment of sense contact, pasa, when the mind contacts an object with the senses. And the image here is that of a flayed cow, flayed meaning its skin has been torn off. And if it stands close to the wall, the creatures living on the wall bite and torment it. If it stands in the water, then the creatures in the water bite and torment it. If it stands beside a tree, the creatures on the tree bite and torment it. If it stands in the open air, the creatures flying about in the open air bite and torment it. And this is like the contact of the senses. The sensitive sense organs are like the flayed skin, and the sense objects are like the creatures. The third kind of nutriment is, the literal translation from the Pali would be mental states with intention, mano sanchetana. This is karmic formations, sankharas in the sense of mental volition, chetana, that mental actions by which we make the kama that is the food or nutriment for becoming. And the image here is a pit deeper than the height of a man, filled with charcoal, glowing red hot. And a man is being dragged towards the charcoal pit by two bigger, stronger men, grabbing him by the arms, and they're going to throw him in the charcoal. And the charcoal pit is samsara, the various worlds of becoming. And the two burly men dragging him along by the arms are good and bad karma that carry us along into becoming, skillful and unskillful karma. The final kind of nutriment is consciousness, vijnana. And it's specifically explained that this means rebirth linking consciousness. It's the same as in the dependent origination. It's patisanda vijnana. And the analogy for this is the king's men capture a robber, a bandit, and ask the king what punishment should be inflicted on this man. And the king says, early in the morning, strike him with 100 spears. So they go and strike him with 100 spears. Then at midday, the king asks, how is that man that you captured? And they say, he still is alive. Well, go and strike him with 100 spears again. And they go and do it again. And then in the evening time, the king asks, how is that man that you captured? He still lives, my lord. Well, go and strike him with 100 spears again. And this is rebirth linking consciousness that again and again strikes us and pierces us, causing us to come into a new becoming. So this four kinds of nutriment taking together, one of the important aspects of understanding this concept of nutriment is as another facet or view of the idea of not-self, that there is no permanent substantial essence. There's the continuous process that we only exist by the various forms of nutriment flowing through. The body is composed of material components that are continually being taken in, processed, and excreted. And it's the same with the mind. The mind is continually being refreshed and renewed and is fed by an input of sensations, sense impressions, as well as ideas. And this process altogether is the process of samsara, of becoming, in the various kinds of being. They're all sustained by nutriment. The body is described as born of mother and father, sustained by rice and gruel. It's a process. It's not a possession. It's not a abiding substance. And the same for the mind. The mind is continual processing of impressions, information, data, and so forth. And our existence is a process of becoming as enumerated in the dependent arising. We keep coming into birth again and again through this processing. So I think that's sufficient to introduce the topic, and I'll turn it over to my colleague here.
So as Tanajan just pointed out, one way of thinking about this is that what the Buddha is telling us about the process of being a being, the process of existence, is nothing more than the process of continual feeding. There's no moment of existence that isn't being sustained somehow or other by some kind of taking in of nutriment, either nutriment for the body or nutriment for the mind. And as he also pointed out, this underscores the characteristic of our existence as being not self throughout. And it has to do really with this aspect of dependent origination. The teaching on nutriment shows up in several places in the suttas. There's a sutta in which the Buddha is quizzing Sariputta, and he's asking Sariputta about some point of dependent origination, and he kind of prompts him, and he says, do you see, Sariputta, what has come to be? What has come to be? And Sariputta takes the clue, and he says, on account of... He literally kind of goes through the simplest version of dependent origination and couches it in terms of nutriment. So when this exists, that comes to be. When this ceases to exist, that ceases to be. So the this and the that, and that formulation of dependent origination, are any two links in the chain of dependent origination. So for example, when there is birth, then aging and death comes to be. With the cessation of birth, there is the cessation of aging and death. So this linkage between birth and death is kind of the starting point in many ways for coming to understand dependent origination. And nutriment is another way of understanding dependent origination, or kind of having an entry into an understanding of dependent origination. When it comes to edible food, in that the sutta that Ajahn was talking about, that sutta is in the Samyutta Nikaya, it's called the sun's flesh. And of course, that refers to the first of the four similes. And so the edible food is compared to having to subsist on the sun's flesh, that nutriment. The nutriment of sense contact is compared to being a flayed cow, constantly being attacked by little creatures. The nutriment of mental volition is compared to being grabbed by two strong men and dragged towards a pit of glowing embers. And the nutriment of consciousness is compared to being a prisoner struck by 300 spears every day. So who says Buddhism is not a feel-good religion? So in that sutta, the Buddha goes to some trouble to point out that these similes are meant to give us a way to regard these nutriments. He says, the nutriment of edible food should be regarded in this way, as though it were this extremely unlovable form of food. You know, like, you don't eat it for pleasure, you're not eating it for fattening, you're eating it just in order to cross the desert. That's the only reason you're eating it. And the reason to regard it that way is not because food is bad, and not because no sort of like judgmental prudishness around food, or some kind of Puritan or ascetic ideals about food, but because if the nutriment of edible food is comprehended, then that practitioner will also comprehend the lust for the five chords of sensual pleasure. So it's necessarily the case that if you really understand the nutriment of edible food and its relationship to your body and your own mind's grasping at the body, the reason that the mind grasps at food has to do with the fact that it wants to exist and that it's grasping at the body. And that eating itself, feeding on edible food, generates sensations of pleasure, especially if one is hungry. And pleasure and lust are tied together. That lust for pleasant sensation is one of the things that binds beings to the wheel of samsara. It's one of the fetters. It's one of the things which tie us to constantly being born and dying. So if you really understood edible food, then you'd understand all about lust for pleasant sensations, for the eye, for the ear, for the body, tongue, and nose. So those are the five chords of sensual pleasure. Understanding edible food allows you to understand lust for those five chords of sensual pleasure. And one who fully understands lust for the five chords of sensual pleasure, one who fully understands lust, sees how it creates suffering, sees how it leads to birth and death. And with that understanding, with that comprehension, that practitioner is able to abandon that lust, to detach himself or herself from that lust, and in doing so, free him or herself from being enslaved by craving for sensual pleasure. That person, by definition, becomes a non-returner, an anagami. That's the third stage of enlightenment after stream entry and becoming a once-returner. The third stage is becoming a non-returner. A non-returner has broken the fetter of lust. So that's the value of coming to understand deeply and thoroughly edible food. And that one's, you could say, the most accessible because we have to deal with it every day. It's very concrete. It's easy to undertake the practice to start regarding it as an unlovely necessity for crossing over the desert rather than something to be grasped at and enjoyed. The other three nutriments have a similar structure in this sutta. So the nutriment of contact, so sense contact. We're always being contacted. The great thing about that simile of the flayed cow, well, besides being memorable, is it illustrates the fact that the flayed cow, she doesn't have any choice. Contact happens whether you like it or not. As soon as you open your eyes in the morning, contacts start flooding in, and there's nothing you can really do about it. This particular form of nutriment, unlike edible food, this particular form of nutriment shoves itself into you, whether you are pursuing it or not. What contact does, whenever the senses are contact, in the chain of dependent origination, contact brings about feeling. Every time there's contact, any sort of sense contact, there will be a feeling, either a pleasant feeling, a neutral feeling, or an unpleasant feeling. And those three feelings are the basis for craving. Craving to have more of what you like, and craving to have less of what you don't like. So one who fully comprehends contact as a nutriment for the mind comes to fully understand all three kinds of craving, all three kinds of feeling, pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral. If you fully understand contact and you fully understand feeling, then you've understood the linkage between two of the classical links in the chain of dependent origination. So contact conditions feeling, feeling conditions craving, craving conditions clinging, clinging conditions becoming, becoming conditions birth, birth conditions aging and death, sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair. So that's the major arc of the chain of dependent origination. So if you can get any one of those two links, then you've got an entry into the entire chain. And you have a kind of a place where you can, in effect, break the chain of dependent origination. And that's what liberation is to be able to no longer be enslaved by this chain of constant becoming. The next nutriment for the sustaining of living beings is the mental volition. As Tanajan said, it's mano sanchetana. And this particular nutriment has to do with the mind wanting things. So it's the desire, it's the mind wanting to be, wanting to do, wanting to have, wanting to know, wanting to become. It's that which leads to becoming. It's also the craving to experience, especially to experience pleasant sensations. One who fully understands this particular nutriment comes to fully understand the three kinds of craving. The first noble truth is the noble truth of unsatisfactoriness or suffering. The second noble truth is the cause of suffering, and the cause of suffering is three kinds of craving. Craving for sense pleasures, craving for becoming, and craving for annihilation or non-becoming. One who fully understands the nutriment of mental volition comes to fully comprehend the three kinds of craving. And that means that that person has fully understood the second noble truth. One who understands the second noble truth has obviously understood the first noble truth. And the third noble truth is the cessation of becoming, cessation of suffering. And so again, a person who is able to do this understands two of the links of dependent origination and is able to break the entire chain. The last nutriment for living beings is consciousness. This is where we get struck by 300 spears, morning, noon, and night. And this one is to be regarded in this way, to be regarded as this kind of affliction of being stricken by spears, because one who understands consciousness, which is this nutriment, comes to understand name and form, nama rupa. nama rupa and name and consciousness are a particular point in the chain of dependent origination. And it's interesting that this is a unique point. So the classic chain is, on account of ignorance, there are sankharas or formations. On account of formations, there's consciousness. On account of consciousness, there's name and form. On account of name and form, there are the six sense bases. On account of the six sense bases, there is contact. On account of the contact, there's feeling. And it kind of goes down the chain all the way to birth, aging, and death. What the Buddha, when he was contemplating dependent origination prior to his enlightenment, he started with birth and death and worked his way backwards. He said, when what is present, does aging and death come to be? And it's obviously that he concludes that it's when birth is present, aging and death comes to be. So when what is present, does birth come to be? When becoming is present, birth comes to be. So this is working backwards up the chain. And the way to see these things is through a process called wise attention or radical reflection, yoniso manasikara. And this is a kind of contemplation that one does when one is doing advanced vipassana work. So when the Buddha was doing his work, he first figured out how the chain of dependent origination, how one thing is caused by or is conditioned by or is dependent upon the presence of something prior to it. And then he worked it backwards. When what is absent, does this thing become absent? And he realized that when consciousness is absent, when consciousness ceases, name and form ceases. He also realized that when name and form ceases, consciousness ceases. In other words, name and form and consciousness condition each other. Ordinarily, it seems like dependent origination is like a row of dominoes. If one knock falls down, they all fall down. And if one is standing up, they're all standing up. But name and form basically knock each other down and push each other up. And in effect, one of the analogies that's used in the suttas is that the name and form sort of lean on each other like two sheaves of grain and been gathered together, and they're kind of leaning on each other. If one of them falls down, the other one falls down. But as long as one of them standing up, it supports the other one. So the two constantly create each other in this kind of back and forth flow between consciousness and name and form. So one who fully understands consciousness and how it comes to be, fully understands name and form and how it comes to be, and also understands the cessation of the two. And he says, the Buddha says in the sutta, several of the suttas, that when he understood this relationship of mutual becoming, mutual arising, between name and form and consciousness, that's when he knew he had a pathway to enlightenment. That's when he knew he was enlightened. So a practitioner who follows that path comes to the same conclusion. So for each one of those mental nutriments, contact, mental volition, and consciousness, those three, one who fully comprehends them has an entryway to fully comprehending the entirety of dependent origination, and they become fully enlightened. So you could say the fully comprehending edible food gets you to partial enlightenment, which is a pretty good deal, but fully comprehending mental nutriment gets you all the way to the final goal. So that's the importance of nutriment, and because it's another way of understanding dependent origination, or sort of entering into dependent origination, the practices that the Buddha is recommending are something that we take up as practitioners. And the practices are contained in those similes. We regard edible food as an unpleasant but necessary support without attaching lustfully to it in order to understand lust. We regard contact as sort of being nibbled at by little creatures all the time against our will in order to come to fully understand the feeling that's created by that nibbling. We regard mental volition, the way the mind wants to do things, wants to have things, wants to know things, we regard that as being dragged towards some kind of horrible doom, being dragged towards a burning embers, so that we can fully comprehend the tendency for the mind to go after things, the three kinds of craving. And we regard consciousness as being struck by spears, rather than attaching to it as like, this is my consciousness, valuing consciousness, seeing consciousness as a good thing. Regard it in this way, and you're on your way to fully comprehending how it is that consciousness creates name and form. Name and form creates consciousness. And those two together are what's keeping us trapped in the constant becoming of dependent origination. So I'll leave that for my part of the talk, and I'll give it back to the Ajahn.
I think we can see from these examples how the Buddhist teaching is a many-faceted jewel. It's been compared to that. If you look in at any from any angle, you'll see the whole thing. It all comes together. It's all expression, different ways of expressing fundamental truths. And this particular facet, the idea of nutriment in all the four kinds, is really emphasizing the process of the existence as a process. Contemplating in this way helps to undermine a sort of substantialist, implicit substantialist bias in the mind, that we tend to think of the body, consciousness, feelings, and so on in terms of solid entities. Part of this is an inevitable result of the language. Whether it's English or Pali, we're forced to use nouns to describe these things, rather than seeing them as verbs, as a process, as things moving through. The emphasis on this process is on the process of becoming into existence. This is a way of looking at samsara, not as a place or a domain, a thing, but as an action, something we do. We do samsara. Samsara literally means the wandering, wander, and we're wandering on through these various states of becoming, like the man being dragged towards the charcoal pit. And the force of the ones who are doing the dragging is the force of karma, that our volitional actions, our movements of the mind propel us endlessly into becoming. And the fourth nutriment of consciousness, being struck by spears, is the fruition of that, is the coming into existence. As Tankhamiko was elucidating about the dependent origination, this is the first few links in the dependent origination. Because of ignorance, there are volitional formations. Karma is made. And because of karma, there is consciousness. Rebirth linking consciousness is conditioned by previous karma. And because of that rebirth linking consciousness, there is then body and mind, name and form, namarupa. The initial beginning of a new being is the spark of consciousness arising. In the case of a human birth, it arises at the moment of conception. The consciousness provides the initial spark for the unfolding of the being and a development into what it will eventually become, which is name and form. This is all the peculiarities of the body and mind. And once the being is born with body and mind, name and form, it has the six senses. And the six senses are like the skin of the flayed cow. They provide the opportunity for the infliction of contact. And with contact there is feeling, and with feeling it becomes craving. And with craving is conditioned upadana, clinging. There's also a variation in a couple of places where the Buddha, this is again brings us back to nutriment, Well, there's the one sutta working backwards from nutriment, where the Buddha says that there is nutriment. What is the cause of nutriment? It comes about from craving. And then he runs through the dependent origination backwards from there. So, in a sense, nutriment is an equivalent of clinging. It's not so evident in the English, but in Pali, the word for nutriment is ahara, and the word for clinging is upadana. And ahara comes from, as many kind of abstract nouns in Pali do, it's a derivation from a verbal root. It means a taking up, picking up. Harati is to carry. Ahari is to take up, pick up. And upadana, it more literally means fuel. So fuel is very similar to nutriment. So we get caught in this web of dependent origination because of our craving for nutriment, which is the fuel of becoming. And when this process is understood, then it can be broken. The Buddha gave this sutta of the four similes at a time when the monks were enjoying an abundance of alms food. So they were getting kind of complacent and sloppy in their practice, enjoying the luxurious food every day. So he gave this sutta on contemplation of the four nutriments. One of the 40 contemplations in the Visuddhimagga is contemplation of the repulsiveness of nutriment. You know, we tend to look at with the untutored mind, with the reflex, you know, the natural reflex of the mind is to see food as something, you know, as a sense pleasure, something enjoyable, and to avoid being caught in the craving and sensuality of nutriment. The contemplation given by the Buddha was the contemplation of the repulsiveness of nutriment, and it's contemplated in different ways. One is in the difficulty of acquiring. This teaching was given for bhikkhus, so it talks about going on alms round and having to walk over rough ground and walk a long way. Alms round can be arduous. Sometimes it's fairly easy, but it depends on your route and where you're going. And it's traditionally done in bare feet. And sometimes we'd walk for a couple of kilometers over like sharp gravel, you know, or maybe it's pouring of rain. You got to walk through mud mixed with buffalo dung. And of course, acquirement of nutriment for lay people is also, it's not easy. It doesn't fall like manna from heaven. You have to go out and get a job and work. And in one way or another, there's an arduous effort made by beings to attain nutriment. As a great deal of our physical energy is expended to the quest for nutriment. In the normal condition of most humans throughout history, it was probably almost every day, all day. You know, you're digging in the field or hunting in the bush or trying to rustle up the day's grub. There's the contemplation of nutriment as repulsive due to the bodily secretions. That when we eat, we make saliva and bile, and it's this sort of disgusting process of actually digesting. You know, it's only the first moment of taking it in that's sensually attractive. And so after that, it's just, you know, disgusting, chewed up muck going through, and then the excretion. It's only in your body for a day, and then, you know, it's down in the outhouse hole. It's pretty disgusting. So there's different ways of contemplating, you know, looking at the process of nutriment in a stark way. The analogy of the sun's flesh is a very powerful one. So reading the essay Jnanapanika wrote on this sutta, and he makes the point that this is the killing of the sun to eat the food is particularly apt because it's virtually impossible to eat without it involving some destruction of living beings, some killing. Obviously with meat, it's an obvious direct application, but even a vegetarian diet involves the destruction of numerous, countless living beings. When the field is plowed, there's countless worms and beetles and things that are destroyed. This was actually something that moved the young bodhisattva's mind when he watched the plowing ceremony as a youth. He saw the ground being turned up and all the insects being killed and birds coming and eating the remnants of the worms and so on. As well as Jnanapanika points out, the destruction of habitat to provide arable land kills numerous beings and so on. So the whole process of living beings is eating or being eaten. And the process of coming into being through nutriment is also expressed in the cosmological cycle. It's a very important key episode in the myth of the origin of beings on this earth. Because when this earth first formed and congealed, there was the first beings who appeared here came down from the Abhisara realm. They were Brahma beings that were self-luminous, feeding on bliss, which is a nutriment of Brahma beings. They don't take external nutriment. They feed self-generated on piti, on rapture. And they were basically, you could say, in orbit around the earth. They were in the air above the earth, and as the earth formed and congealed, there appeared on the surface of the earth like skim on boiled milk. There appeared the nutritive essence, oja. This word oja is nutritive essence. This is also used as considered to be the essence of anything we eat, the essence that sustains us, the vital energy is the oja, is the nutritive essence in food. And this formed in a very concentrated way on the surface of the planet. And these Abhisara beings became curious about it. And some of them tasted it by taking up a little bit on the tip of their finger. And once they took in physical nutriment, then they fell from that state of being Abhisara beings, and they fell to earth and began the process of devolving into humans. And as they evolved over the aeons, or devolved, falling all the time towards a less refined state, the food source devolved along with them. The nutritive essence turned into something like fungus, and that turned into some sort of ferny plants, and that turned eventually into rice. And the first rice was miraculous from our point of view in that it grew on the vine already like white rice cooked. And people would just gather enough for a meal and warm it up. And they also had like magical stones that they could put three of them together in a circle and they would glow red hot, and you could put a pot on top of it and warm your rice. And this sustained them for a long time until the defilement of greed and laziness crept into people, and they start saying, why should we bother gathering the rice every time we want to eat? Why don't we just gather a whole bunch in a sack and have enough to eat for a week? And so they did that, but that stressed out the plants, and the plants devolved into the rice that we know today, which requires a lot of labor. I don't know how aware people are of rice cultivation. It's extremely labor intensive. The rice plants have to be grown in water and then transplanted at a certain stage, one by one, to a dry bed. And then once it's gathered, it has to be threshed to make the white rice, and the husks have to be beaten off it. And finally, it has to be cooked. So the process of physical nutriment of food as a process is entwined into the very, you know, nature and fabric of beings. The life experience of different classes of beings is entwined, if not defined, by their food, you know, and the process of gaining, acquiring, and enjoying the nutriment. And various forms of contact, you know, also define beings. Well, the types of, you know, all beings are in a sense flayed cows, but the type of nibbling insects that we experience as human beings are quite different than those experienced by the lower animals, or by hell being, or by devas. Contact in the deva realms is entirely pleasant and yields only pleasant feeling, which, while it may be enjoyable while it lasts, it is impermanent, and it does have the disadvantage of not having the contrast between pleasant and unpleasant feeling. Makes it more difficult to understand the nature of feeling and to gain this liberation that we're talking about, which is one of the probably the key advantage of being in a human birth, is that the mix of pleasant and unpleasant and neutral feelings does allow for that exploration and understanding more easily. All three kinds of feelings are in essence dukkha. They're not all suffering in the narrow meaning of the English word, but they are all dukkha. The feelings that are engendered by unpleasant sensation is dukkha dukkata, which is like dukkha as dukkha, or dukkha per se. This obvious dukkha, you know, you step on a hot coal with your bare foot, that's obvious suffering. There's no deep philosophical conundrum to understanding that. It's, you know, this is feeling as suffering. Pleasant sensations are viparinama dukkha. They're suffering due to changeableness, because no pleasant sensation is lasting or ultimately satisfying. There's no pleasant sensation anywhere in the universe that is fully satisfying to the mind. Maybe it's a little counterintuitive, not easily grasped, but it's very important, and it's really one of the things that really traps beings in becoming, is the quest for ultimate satisfaction. And the extreme example of this is the story of King Mandatu, who was a wheel-turning monarch who conquered the whole earth, the four continents. And it's said that the sense pleasures enjoyed by a wheel-turning monarch is the highest possible, the most refined, the most enjoyable possible for a human being. So, you know, he had every possible enjoyment for a long period of time. His lifespan was measured in tens of thousands of years. He was enjoying these pleasures. And then he finally still could never be satisfied, never have enough. So he asked his advisors, is there any place else left to conquer that even more beautiful and refined enjoyment may be had? And they said, the kingdom of the four great kings, the gods on Mount Sinuru. So he led his armies and the wheel up there. And it's one of the characteristics of a wheel-turning monarch is that they conquer without sword and stick. It's no violence, but just the imposing appearance of the king and his retinue and his fourfold army and the giant wheel in the sky. All the other sub-kings prostrate themselves and surrender. So he conquered the gods of the four great kings and ruled in there for tens of thousands of years more, and still grew dissatisfied. So then he found out that on the top of Mount Sinuru is the kingdom of Tawatingsa, even more wonderful and refined. And so he repeated the exercise and shared the rule of Tawatingsa with Saka, the king of the gods. And it said that he lived through, I think it's 16 grains of Sakka. Sakka lives for 56 million years, and 16 Sakkas lived and died while this fellow continued his existence. And then he thought to himself, he's still not satisfied. He thought, why should I share this kingdom with this Sakka? Why don't I just kill him and take the whole works? But once he had that unworthy thought, he fell back to earth. And he lay broken in the garden of his old palace. As he was dying, his people came to see him, and they asked him if he had any message for the people. And he said, tell them that sense pleasures cannot be satisfied. I conquered the whole earth and the heavens, and I still could not satisfy sense desire. So that second piece of chocolate cake is not going to do it for you. And the feeling of this long digression to explain the feeling of pleasant sensation also leads to dukkha. Neutral feeling is suffering as an intrinsic quality. It's dukkha sankhata. That dukkha is intrinsic in all things, and with the neutral feeling, it's experienced as a subtle form of suffering, as boredom, as dullness, because of the imperfection. Which is another aspect, important aspect of understanding dukkha, is the imperfection of all things, because things are imperfect, provisional. Now, this is what drives the process of becoming. This is what causes the 100 spears in the morning, noon, and night, is driving onwards, because whatever we experience is incomplete, imperfect, and we're trying to always complete it, find that which will satisfy the mind, which can't be had, and the mind is continually moving on, driven on. And we take various actions in the world, which is the energy of these burly guards who are dragging us to the charcoal pit. So to sum up, this teaching about the four nutriments, and it comes up many times in the suttas from different angles. It's yet another beginning point, starting point for looking at the whole teachings. I mean, we see how it comes, the Four Noble Truths, the dependent origination. It all comes, the five aggregates, it all comes together, and once we start expanding from this single point of nutriment, it moves out into all these other realms, and it all comes together.